Okay, welcome everybody. 8 a.m. on a Saturday, but everyone here is going strong. That's good. This is Writing, Write, and Dialogue and Dialects. How to do dialogue, conversations, make your speech sound rational, and not as if it had been spoken at 8 in the morning, unless that was what you initially intended. What I want to do before we get underway is let everybody introduce themselves quickly. You may have seen these fine people already at some point this weekend, but if not, let's introduce them and then we'll get into it. So if you start, Don, with you.
Hi, my name's Tom Bingle. I'm a gamer and writer, 30 published short stories, 3 books, a couple of these anthologies, but I just focus on Impact. Also have a bunch of stuff, including that Impact available on Nook and Kindle. And yeah, some of my characters have spoken in dialects.
I'm Jean, and I've written a bunch of stuff. I just finished a book before I came here, so I'm happy about that. And she, I do don't have a bunch of characters to talk funny. Because I used to work down in Kentucky where they all talk like this on a couple car farms. A couple car farms on a regular basis down by Louisville.
Did you ever check it with them? Make sure you were right?
On how they done spell things?
Right, yeah.
Well, once in a while, but they don't get themselves past that name.
Okay. Well, I'm not even going to try to follow that. I was like, I'm going to be witty, but my brain's not functioning. I'm good. I gave some to my daughter this morning. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University, where I hear all kinds of dialogue and dialects from my students. I teach courses in science fiction and fantasy and creative writing. First novel came out 2 years ago. I have it for sale here from 5 Star, edited by John Helfers, also a member of the symposium. The only other thing I've been pitching this weekend is that I run a show with Brad Bollier, also of the symposium, called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, where we interview, talk about writing from the speculative fiction field, and also interview artists, editors, authors, and other notables and luminaries of the field. And you can find that at speculatesf.com.
And you just had a big article published in the Bulletin.
That's right, thank you. And I had an article published in the CIFWA Bulletin just recently out on networking and doing things like coming to conventions and speaking to authors like this. And that may or may not have been edited by one Jean Raby, who had some cops done past at her before, sitting to my left. So I guess we should throw a question out for all of us first, which is, what have we all had to do in terms of making dialogue and dialects work properly in fiction? And Jean, since you kind of let off with some, maybe I can start with you and ask a little bit about, because for you, it's also about police procedurals and mysteries and thrillers where you've got to get the dialect right, not just in a fantasy world, but in a realistic setting. So how do you do it?
I used to be a police reporter. So I kind of understand how cops talk. And I still hang around with some cops in Kenosha just because I like the flavor. Police in different regions of the country will speak different. I had an editor tell me that I should religiously be watching Law and Order. And he was correct because he was spot on. Those people who were doing the original Law and Order knew how cops talked. And it was kind of neat because of the and stuff. The big problem with writing a dialect, and we'll teach you and we'll show you resources on how to get it correct, but when you want to translate what someone is saying to you, and when I was doing my hick accent, I covered police down in western Kentucky, and she, I really did do talk a lot of that, and I would listen to the scanner. And sometimes I would have to go across the hall, because I ran a little news bureau, to the insurance agent who had an office. I would get him to come listen to the scanner, and I'd say, okay, what do they mean? Because for the longest time, I didn't know what a corpor was. I had no idea what a corpor was. And it's a car was on fire. And in western Kentucky, they frequently burned their cars for insurance money. So you want to translate that into writing. But it's difficult to do it, to get the accent across, and to have the reader not stumble over your writing. Because when you can correctly display an accent through spelling, through character mannerization, especially things like when you're talking about she, you can write that. S-H-E-E-O-O-O-T. You know, you can get all sorts of little dialects across that way. Nawlins, you spell it N-A-W-L-I-N-S. And most people know that you're talking about New Orleans. And you want to use some of this to get the flavor because it creates a much brighter picture in your reader's mind. But you have to know when to hold back. You sprinkle in these words. You know, you don't do a whole sentence. Because while it works on the screen, while it works on television, while it works in movies, you will stop your reader cold like a roadblock. Every single word as they're mentally trying to translate it. So it's like taking a pepper shaker and just sprinkling a little bit of it on the page, just to get them the idea, or just to get them the idea about a particular character. You might have a character, one character on your book that keeps going, she, you'd, and you can use that as a trigger to introduce this character. But you do not have to put the entire sentence in that freaking stupid Western Gitoxy. You know, just, so that's my two cents to start.
Well, and to extend your analogy, though, you don't just pepper the first bite and stop. I have actually heard people say, oh, well, we put the first sentence in dialect, and then they know that he speaks dialect, and you put all the rest of it, just, you know, and it's like, no, that doesn't work for me. You need to occasionally remind the reader of the accent. When you sprinkle with your pepper shaker there, isn't entirely even. And so you want to get a little bit more or a little bit less flavor at various points when you go through with the person's speech. The other thing I want to say that I think has been touched on is we're not just talking about regional dialects. Jean touched on it when she was talking about cop speak, but different people in different contexts and different professions speak in different ways. And, you know, Jean did the very nice Kentucky accent as we started, and then Greg said he wasn't going to follow up, but he did in professorial tones. And people who teach regularly for a living sound a certain way often. I have a friend. I asked him for some help on something, and it was just a very casual project, but I knew instantly, I didn't know everything about this friend's background, I knew instantly he had been in customer service or a computer company, because just the way he spoke. Well, first, look here, and in the upper left-hand corner, you can see, this is so, you know, he obviously had everything memorized that would be on the screen of my computer, and, you know, knew exactly how to tell it to me in a way that would be helpful and very, very precise. You need to use those differences also. I speak differently in work mode than I do at home. And every once in a while, I'll be at home, and my wife will say, stop speaking in work mode, because I tend to speak with more authority, I try to be more precise when I'm at work, and she doesn't necessarily appreciate that all the time. So you have to zero in on those subtleties, too.
I think Don brings up an excellent point, and one of the things that I want to point out about that is that when you're thinking about, we're also going to talk about dialogue too, but dialects, or whether we're talking about geographical areas or whether we're talking about professions, the key thing to keep in mind is when you're trying to capture something from a particular geographical area, you're dealing with numerous subsets most of the time within that geographical area. And so the fact that, you know, policemen speak a certain way in a certain vernacular, you'll have professors, to use that example, who will, when teaching, speak in a similar vernacular but with differences. And I think the big way to distinguish those things is in the rhythm of how their speech sounds. One thing that drives me crazy about dialects that aren't well done is when they don't sound rhythmically right. When it sounds as if someone has taken a group of disparate words that technically are the phonetic versions of, you know, something that someone would say, like past when you mean pissed, and then just do nothing but that on the page. And the result is that you have sort of like the, you know, jerky automaton of the dialect you're trying to represent. And it doesn't flow, and it feels as if someone has done, like, you know Google Translate, right? You ever gone to a page that Google Translate has handled? And it kind of gets it right. But it's very much as if it's translating the page, you know.
Google Translate,
well, sorry?
It's like Babel.
Yeah, it's like Babelfish. It'll translate any page in any language or most languages to English.
Is this called Google Translate?
Google Translate, yeah.
And
Babelfish, I know about, but know less about it than Google Translate. But it will translate any page, any language from a page into English. But it will do it very much in a kind of, and they're trying to smooth it out, but still, it's very kind of rigid, and it makes it sound like, you know, if you got directions like a safety manual that read, you know, you are safety, reader here, you would have the, and you know, you kind of get what it's saying, but no one would actually ever speak like this. And I would venture to say, in fact, I know this for a fact, I've been to, I've several times been to Western Kentucky, to a couple of small schools, small colleges out in Western Kentucky. And I will tell you that as you listen to people speak, there are even some professors on those campuses who wouldn't know what the heck a Kawa is if they heard it, you know, just because, and they've, you know, grown up and lived in Western Kentucky, but they speak differently constantly. They don't live that as part of their, you know, regular lives, and so they wouldn't necessarily know what that meant. And so the key thing to keep in mind is that you're trying to represent not just one specific area, you're trying to represent subsets of that area. And a good way to do that is to think about the rhythm of how it sounds. And the best way to do that is to listen. Not just to listen to things like Law and Order, though that's a great place to start, but also if you're going to set your place in a specific geographical region, to actually do the research of, if possible, going there, or at least spending as much time as possible gathering information about it by listening to the people. YouTube is a wonderful resource for this because you can sometimes find videos on YouTube or Vimeo or places like that in which you have people having conversations from those various geographical regions, and you can simply listen to the cadence, to the rhythm, and then start thinking about how you're actually going to translate that to the page. And so rhythm is just as important as the way the words actually look.
This convention is a wonderful venue for that. Every time I come to this convention or another big convention, I will find a bench someplace and I will take out a notebook. I've already got several pages from this year. And I will listen to people.
Yeah.
Because at this convention, people come from all over the world. I met a couple of men yesterday from Bolivia. I went up to them and I asked them where they were from because I thought their accents were really kind of interesting and they were speaking English but not quite right. So that was kind of neat. They came all the way from Bolivia. There's some other gentlemen that I met here from Italy. And you just sit and you listen and you write down snippets of conversation. Linda Baker, who's not here this year, used to love to do that. She'd go to bookstores and she would write down people's conversation. And she, one of her favorite quotes is, I got me some friends of mine. And I would have a clerk. I had a clerk when I worked at TSR. And her idioms was, well, I was talking to this person, then I goes, and then he goes, and then I goes, and then he goes. I'm like, holy. But I've used it. But like, take a few minutes and go sit on one of the benches out here and get a notebook. Just listen to people. Just kind of neat.
Another question I want to ask everyone is, so it's one thing to actually hear it. How do you keep from overwriting it? How do you actually get the rhythm and the cadence of what you hear, and you know the word choices, but get them onto the page in a way that you're not dealing with, you know, automaton style? Like when Don was talking about the one line of dialect followed by everything else, I was thinking of that scene from Hunt for Red October, when you know they first introduced Sean Connery's, you know, the Russian captain, and so there's a few lines where he speaks in Russian, and then the camera does this cool sweep-in thing, and then all of a sudden he's speaking English, and you understand he's actually speaking Russian because Sean Connery didn't want to spend 2 hours trying to speak Russian dialogue when he, you know, had other things to say. And that was cool for that movie, but that obviously doesn't, you know, function the same way in a book, or at least it doesn't function that way when you're dealing with dialect. So what do we think about actually getting the stuff from here to...
Well, from an editor's standpoint, you want to get it tipped out from a writer's standpoint. But from an editor's standpoint, what I like to see an author do is to, when you're keying on different characters, there are certain words that are often used that they will write a certain way. And you just stick to this little group of, say, a dozen words that you'll use this funky spelling on to convey a dialect or an accent, so that the reader automatically knows that this particular word means this, like shoot, you know, or I don't know. But, or cause, you know, for cousin, or cause for because, depending on what you put. But you just have this little list of words, and these are the only ones that you use for this particular character to convey this particular type of speech. Because then you don't have the roadblock situation, because the reader automatically translates this word as this word and knows that you're speaking. And I don't like them to overuse it. Often I like them to use it in the first three words in a sentence, because then you get the dialogue right up front, and then the rest of the sentence you can just smoothly read. So you're introducing the character, the speech pattern again. But that's, from an editor's standpoint, makes much smoother reading in translating. The other thing that you can do from an editor's standpoint is you can have, I hate to keep using Hicks, but my writer's group is writing folksy stuff right now, set in like Western Virginia. People there tend not to use G. They don't say sitting, walking, it's walking, sitting. And so in the dialogue, you just take the G off of the end of it when a particular person is talking. And that's a real easy thing for a reader to see and know what the word is just by dropping that last G. You know, and some of the words that I was talking about that you might use is like taint instead of ain't. Just kind of pick and choose. Don't try to go too elaborate or the editor will go. Next manuscript.
You know, I don't know how everybody else writes, but when I write, I tend to think cinematically. It's because I watch way too many movies and TV, and keep telling myself that watching TV is good for my writing.
It is.
And so, in my mind, the scene that I'm writing plays in my head as I write it, and I hear what people say. They don't tell it to me, and I write it down. I tell them what they say, and they perform it. But that is helpful to me because I hear it. And if you don't write that way, or people aren't speaking in your head, and you think I'm insane, you can replicate this in a way by just speaking the dialogue out loud. And yes, you may not be as good of an actor as imaginary people in your mind, but it is still very helpful to hear how things actually sound. And one of the values, by the way, of reading, authors doing readings and reading their manuscripts aloud, is that you will hear things in terms of rhythm, words that make the dialect sound wrong, things that make the conversation sound like it is not coming from the profession that you want. When you say them out loud, or at least listen to them out loud in your head, that you will not when you read them. And then you'll realize that there's something that is pulling the reader out of the story and needs to be fixed. So if you cannot command voices in your head, do try reading your dialogue out loud, and see how the cadence actually goes.
I think that's incredibly important for a number of reasons. And one of the big reasons is I think there's a certain kind of, I don't know how to put this, there's a certain kind of respect, I think, that you need to give the people who are speaking at any one time. And cliches normally happen when people really haven't been interested in what their character is saying or how they say it, but they needed them to be a placeholder at this moment, you know? So if you find yourself running across a character that's speaking in an astonishing cliched way, that is sometimes an indication that you've written a character that you don't view as anything more than a two-dimensional prop in the first place. And that's problematic. people tend to speak somewhat subtly, and the effect of their dialect or their, you know, their accent or whatever else comes out over the course of a series of words. You know, yes, you might hear y'all and think this person is somewhere from the American South, but there's a lot of area in the American South, and y'all is not the same thing in Virginia as it is in Florida, as it is in Mississippi, as it is in Alabama. And so part of what you need to think about then is how to sort of do the nuance of a particular phrase. One way to do that is to have characters, and sometimes you can actually pull them out of the story a bit and write a short little, even, you know, less than a page long discussion between the characters that you have in your story that is separate in some way from the plot that you're writing. You're simply literally putting the two characters on the page and having them talk to each other. This works only if you have characters who are speaking in different kinds of dialect, by the way, and then see how they sound as they talk to each other. My second novel, which is being shopped at the moment, is a novel called Icarus, and it has two alternating point of view characters. The first is a character called Jelinek, who's about a 3.5 foot tall, red-skinned human who lives in the middle of this dorm, not human, God, 8 o'clock in the morning, creature who lives in a dormant volcano. And I wanted him to sound something like what an Old West prospector might have sounded like, where the G's got dropped a lot. And so you have, you know, when I was out digging for flame petals with Rig, I didn't know what was going to happen. But I did know that there was something I was going to see, and you're kind of dropping some of it. So there's kind of a cadence, a smoothness, a flow that goes from one word to the next, and it's not sort of specific and rigid. My other character, Icarus, who is this 6 foot tall, dark-haired, white-skinned youth with wings, who falls into the center of that volcano and then has to figure out what he's doing there because he's lost his memory. He speaks very much in the Queen's English, you know. So he will fall to the volcano and say, you know, I've never been here before. Why am I here? And he'll speak in his mind thinking about, I had always been most afraid of those who lied, and da-da-da-da-da. Now, if Jelinek came out with a line like, I was most afraid of those who lied and spoke to me, you'd be like, what the hell? You know, and you're like going back, that's not who Jelinek is. So I set up an expectation in the reader of what these two different characters will sound like. And the way to make sure that I'm doing it properly is to have those two characters speaking to each other. Different characters who speak differently, who do share more than they think they do, but at least in terms of their language are quite distinct. So one way sometimes to make sure you're doing dialects right, even different dialects, is to put those dialects in conversation with each other. And especially if those dialects sometimes have trouble understanding each other, like the going over to talk to the, you know, translate what the, you know, police were saying on the shortwave, that can be particularly instructive. So that's another way to think about it too.
And you guys are probably fantasy writers, sci-fi writers. You can translate what we're saying to fantasy fiction. You know, be like, well, I don't want somebody to sound like they're from Western Kentucky or from New York or from California because I'm in this fantasy world. But you can take the context of what we're saying and apply it to fantasy or science fiction.
Yep.
We're talking about speech patterns. We're talking about mannerisms when you're dealing with dialogue. I'll give you a quick example. I did a Dragonlance trilogy where my characters were goblins, and I needed my goblins to talk different than humans. So what I did in my dialogue was, and this was a slave race, I got rid of personal pronouns. Those words did not exist for my goblins. They had no word for I, we, me, he, she, because there was no sense of self. So in writing that kind of dialogue, I had created my own patterns, my own rhythms. Don't ever do that. That was really tough.
I was just going to say, oh my God.
And I did it for 3 books. But it's an example of what you can do. You can also go in, and the internet is amazing. Or slang. You can type in Jamaican slang,
yeah.
Or Civil War slang. And even in a futuristic book, it's kind of cool to sprinkle in some of this old slang or to take it and twist it. Did you know that in Jamaican, there's a phrase, all fruits ripe? And it means everything is wonderful. All fruits ripe, mom? You know, and it's just like, I like that, so I have to translate that, you know, and use it into something.
Yeah.
You can find these wonderful little things and just apply it to fantasy science fiction, especially if you're working on historical. If you're working on something historical, you want to make sure you're using real terminology that they include in speech.
I cheated in kind of two ways in the Spy Thriller. The Spy Thrillers involves an international agency, so I wanted to really make sure that there were other people in the agency besides Americans. And so one of my main characters is Australian. And I have some Australian friends, and one of the things that I know about Australian accents, one of my friends' name is Stephen Wales. But when you get introduced to Stephen Wales, he'll come up to you and say, oh, I need Stephen Wiles. And you go, Wiles? And he says, yes, Wiles. W, you know, and it's like the A sounds like an I. And it actually throws people off. Well, a character in here, his name is Luke Calloway, and he's doing a big presentation to all the bigwigs from all the other countries, and he makes a point when he introduces himself and says his name to say his name with an actual A sound, because he knows everyone gets confused by it. Now, for me to try and convey a hard A as a hard I in type is very difficult. But by having early on in the conversation this, you know, this recognition that hard A's are said as hard I's by Australians, then every time he uses a hard A, I'm hoping that the reader is picking up and making it sound like a hard I. And so I'm doing the accent by having talked or having had the character thought about how the accent is. And he also, you know, there's a random, you know, thought in there about how, you know, everybody who talks to him wants to say G'day, crikey. So, you know, you make fun of the stereotypes of the accent. The other thing I did is it's an international agency, right? And so they're going to have these big conferences, and there's all these people from China and Ireland and Russia and blah, 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 blah. And it's kind of like, I don't want to do a conversation with 12 people simultaneously speaking in dialogue. You know, I don't want it to all sound, you know, plain vanilla English, but I don't want to, you know, really try to get the subtlety right. It's too hard. And so I cheated because of the fact that the way these tele-video conferences, virtual reality conferences actually are set up, no one knows who the speakers are from these countries. They are given avatars, and their voices are changed by the computer. And so early on, there's a mention by the administrative assistant that there's a new routine to help people listening to the conference identify the speaker. Not only is a little flag going to, you know, brighten up above them their avatar when they speak, but the computer is assigned accents. And the accents are, quite frankly, corny. And it irritates the director throughout the book about how corny these accents are. So I get away with using the kind of stereotypical accents. This is true cheating, people. I get away with using the Texas drawl.
You know it now.
Blah, blah,
you
blah.
Know.
This is true cheating. And then at the end, you know, it's kind of like, oh, if this was in a U.S. corporation, you know, we'd be sued for, you know, ethnic harassment or whatever. But if she gets to the end, she cancels the subroutine because it's so blatantly offensive as to how stereotypical the accents are. Well, guys, that's true cheating. You can get away with that occasionally. But if you're going to do those kinds of accents, give an excuse for it. It can work wonders.
Yeah. There's a... You were all here when Don admitted the cheating. But that's actually taking a restriction or a limitation and figuring out a way to literally work with the restriction and limitation and make it into a strength. So I think that's interesting. I was thinking we should probably shift over a little bit into away from dialects a bit and into dialogue. And I wanted to suggest something about one way to do that. We haven't mentioned it yet here, although I've heard it mentioned on other panels, and that is one of the better ways to get a sense of excellent dialogue is to take a look at screenplays, or in particular, live theater. I do some live theater criticism for a website called CurtainUp.com, which is the largest internet theater website in the world, in New York. And one of the things that's interesting to me is figuring out different playwrights who have a good grasp of dialogue. One of the best, who many of you have heard of, is David Mamet, who wrote American Buffalo, and then Glengarry Glen Ross, probably more famously. And one of the things that Mamet does best is getting a sense through dialogue of conversation that seems real to you as you listen to it. Though there's a limitation to it, which I'll get back to in a moment. But as you listen to Mamet's characters interact with each other, particularly American Buffalo, if you ever have a chance to rent, because there's a movie version of it, originally starred Robert Duvall on Broadway, but if you ever have a chance to see a version of it, if it comes, if they're performing it somewhere, or if you have a chance to rent the movie version of it. In American Buffalo, these two characters, both of whom, one of them runs kind of a pawn shop, and the other one is sort of a seedy kind of guy who buys things for him, and it's kind of a long story, but anyway, there's a real kind of edge, almost a violence, to the way that these two people speak to each other. And it's not, normally you wouldn't have people going, well, what's going on there? Not much. I'm just sitting here because I'm going to punch you in the face any minute. That's right, you don't do this horribly awkward, inartful way of producing an edge. But there's something about the way in which the lines are cut off. And that's not just the actors delivering it, it's also the way that the playwright writes it. If you actually read a script by David Mamet, you'll see that he wrote it in this way to kind of represent, again, the rhythm and the cadence in that method. And so Mamet is exceptionally good most of the time in getting his characters to speak to each other in a way that seemed real. And the way Mamet said he did that was, as we've talked about before, by listening to real people from all sorts of different situations and different circumstances and different backgrounds speaking to each other, and as Jean said she did, writing it down in a notebook and sort of thinking about it in those terms. The drawback to Mamet's method, and I think this is a sort of cautionary tale for all of us, is when he goes too far down the rabbit hole and goes too much down the line of dialogue, he kind of overdoes it. And that, to go back to Glengarry Glen Ross, is what happens when all of his real estate agents in that play use MF-er like it's going out of style, like every single one, including to their 70 and 80-year-old clients that they're trying to scam. And that's a point where it just doesn't make sense that grandma's going to come in the room and you're going to say, well, how about mother effing this, and I want to thank you, and mother effing that, and you're like, wait, what? And the person doesn't run screaming for the room. I can tell you right now that most of the people I know, if I spoke to my colleagues who are older and started telling them, let me tell you what I am and effing think about you, I would not be tenured and I wouldn't be speaking to you. I'd be lonely and weeping somewhere. You can't do that, okay? And people are going to speak at different registers at different times to different people. We will speak differently on this panel than we would hanging out at the bar speaking to each other after hours, right? So that's, I think that Mamet goes a little bit too far at times, but even that is instructive in terms of how good he usually is, and when he goes a little bit too far down the rabbit hole, how much he's kind of, driven himself into it. And I can imagine him writing furiously, being, and then they would say this, and these characters have an edge, but not so much that they would lose their minds in this context and start losing potential sales. And so both the successes and failures in that regard of really good dialogue writers like Mamet can be helpful too. What do you think about ways in which people that you go to for excellent dialogue, writers, playwrights, screenwriters?
Well, I certainly think that...
Or shows.
I think you're right about reading screenplays. I think that everybody should write a screenplay. Everybody should write a screenplay. It is so helpful in learning how to make dialogue convey everything. Because you're allowed to do so little description. You're allowed to do no internalization.
Yeah.
And so anything you want to convey is has to be done through dialogue. And if you don't want to write a whole screenplay or you don't want to waste the whole idea on a screenplay, take something that you've written story-wise and try and convert it to a screenplay. And you'll notice that you might have an 8,000-word story. And the dialogue is 1,600 or 2,000 words out of that. Now, the screenplay may only come out at 3,000 or 4,000 words. Screenplays tend to be shorter for the same amount of story than stories. But it's just a wonderful exercise for doing that. And I think reading other screenplays is actually somewhat more helpful than watching the movies or going to actually see the plays, because sometimes it's hard to tell how much of what is being conveyed is from the words and how much is from superior or inferior acting. With a screenplay, you know, the only actors you have are in your head, and so I think it's a better teaching tool.
That's a good point. I look to favorite authors. There are some authors, and when I'm writing fantasy, I don't read fantasy, so I'll give you some non-fantasy examples. McDonald, who wrote the Fletch books, not the goofy Chevy Chase movies, but I believe he's a master at dialogue, and he can go on for multiple pages without an attribution, and you know who's talking. The same way with Ed McBain's 87th Precinct books. Master at dialogue, again, back, forth. You know who's talking, and you don't need the attribution. Elmore Leonard is another good study on dialogue, although he'll kind of drive me nuts. If you're into grammar or anything, he'll drive me nuts. But the other thing that you can take away from some of these authors is you realize that they've got the knack down on how people talk. People don't talk correctly. You talk far better than most, but you're a professor.
And I don't talk like this with my daughter. Or, you know, I would, no. I even talk in different registers depending on where I am.
But yeah. The average person does not speak in complete sentences, does not use grammar correctly, will stammer, and you need to translate that into dialogue. Yeah. But if you actually sit and listen to people, the editor on my first book slammed the manuscript on my desk and said, "Gene, your people talk perfectly. They all speak in perfect English, and people don't do that." Yeah. And he was absolutely right, and I had to rewrite all my dialogue.
On the other hand, if you want to really frighten yourself sometimes sit down and record people talking, hopefully with their permission, and then type it up. And you'll see how bad the conversation is. And the goal is not, when you're writing dialogue for your story or book, to replicate what you just typed up and how bad it is. Because when you type that up, you will see that it is so bad. It is incomprehensible. There are too many uhs. There are too many drop things. It's because the people speaking to each other may know each other very well. Things are assumed before they finish their sentences. You need to do real world better. With fewer uhs and interruptions, yep, and dropped sentences and dropped words, so that it mimics real life conversation without getting all the way to perfect, but is still better than real life conversation. Because if you had to read a book in which all of the conversation was literally like most people speak to each other, it would drive you insane.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that quickly, and then we'll open it up for questions and comments. I come from a speech and debate background, and one of the things you notice is that as you listen to people speak, it is astonishing how many verbal tics will sneak in. I edit, as I said, this show, Speculate, this podcast that I do, and one of the verbal tics on this show happens to be, you know. You know. At one point, I kind of said to Brad, you know, we used probably 150 you knows in about a 5-minute span. Do you know how hard that is to do? What does that even mean? And of course, when you say you know, what you're doing essentially is replacing your brain thinking with a word, because nobody likes silence. So instead, people just fill in the gaps all the time, and you will see this all the time with debaters who are in the middle of the style that I did was parliamentary. So people will ask a point of information, they'll stand up and give you a question or a comment that's meant to throw you off. And when debaters are thrown by this, you can tell, because they'll start saying something which literally doesn't have any point at the end of what they said. So someone asks them a question, and they'll say, and that's one of the things I think is really important, because when I consider what you said at that moment that I was talking to you right then, I would realize that that is the brain going, oh, my God, what do I say about this? What do I say about this? Just keep talking. And then all of a sudden, their prose clears out, and all of a sudden, it's as smooth as the Aegean Sea on a nice day, and you're just smooth. And that was because their brain was frantically moving forward. And a little of that in writing goes an incredibly long way. If you tried to represent the you know and ums, if you've ever read a transcript of an interview, you'd be astonished how much the transcript involves ellipses, you know, dot, 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 well, inaudible, breath, you know. It's one of the most annoying things that you could ever possibly read. And so you don't want to duplicate it in your writing, but what you do want to do is give echoes of it, feels of it, and then the brain will literally fill in much of what happens. And that is, by the way, what we often do. We don't necessarily think about the you knows and the us unless we have to sit there and edit a podcast or sit there and listen to someone speaking. Most of the time what we're doing is just sort of letting that stuff go in our head. So as writers, if you can do a little bit of it in your writing, you'll allow your reader to get the flavor for what they're hearing, but not dot, 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 inaudible, breath, mf-er, etc.
By the way, if you want to approximate the typing, recording and typing, and you don't really want to record and type, see if you can get a hold of a deposition transcript. It is cleaner than the normal conversation because the lawyers are trying to be very formal and they're trying to elicit a response that is clean for the court and says what they want for the court to hear. But reading deposition transcripts where, you know, somebody gets asked a question and they respond, the court reporter is sitting there typing the ellipses and sentence fragments and the people talking over each other, which makes depositions difficult to read and difficult for lawyers to use. The other thing I want to say before we open for questions is when I talk about reading aloud, one of the other things that you can pick up on by doing that is whether your attributions are working correctly. One of the most frustrating things for me, if I'm doing a reading for one of my works and there's dialogue in it, is as I'm reading along, I read the dialogue, and then I'll get an attribution that says, she whispered. And it's kind of like, crap, I didn't whisper. And I'm the author, and I should have known better, and I should have whispered. Well, guess what? When your reader is reading, unless you put that attribution beforehand, she whispered. We can't go on. You know, you end up with the reader getting, we can't go on. She whispered. And it throws the reader off in the same way that it throws someone reading aloud off by realizing that the attribution came too late to really affect the impact of the sentence. There are ways to convey that besides simple attribution, too, and we can talk about that. But it's something to keep in mind when the attribution is specifically descriptive of the way they say something, try and put it at the beginning rather than the end. Yeah.
And one other quick thing, and then they need your questions. It dawned on me from an editor's perspective, if you're writing fantasy or science fiction, be very careful when you're using contractions in dialogue, because in a fantasy world, there might not be a race that contracts words like we do in current society, or especially in science fiction. Can't might not exist. No, it might just be cannot or won't. I mean, won't is just kind of a smashed together word. So you have to be conscious of contractions. You also have to be real conscious of cliches. Because what's a cliche now might not have been a cliche if you were writing historical fiction, and certainly might not be a cliche 50 years from now, like the whole nine yards. I mean, that might not exist in another 20 years.
That's a world too terrible to contemplate. I hope it exists forever. I'd suggest if football was coming. Okay, so let's open it up. Do people have questions for us? Wow, lots. Yeah, and then I'll move left.
Earlier about a plot prop character. Sometimes I know, though, it's hard to tell when you've written a plot character because you're attached to them. Any tips for how to do that? Other, like, get it right the first time rather than having to keep.
I'll make one overall comment that isn't just related to dialogue and dialect. Not always, but a lot of times you're very seldom, I shouldn't say very seldom, you will often not get something right the first time. And that's why revision, including both on the page and in the air, when you speak this dialogue, is so important. I think one of the things that happens and has happened increasingly, although you folks can probably tell me this better than I can, especially Gene on the editor side, is that I think people rush things out to such a degree that they feel like they have to produce it, I'm done, move on, and then they don't want to imagine the concept of going through and revising it and dealing with it. And so I think that's a more broad comment, but just to speak to your point, we will often not get this stuff right. You know, when I started doing the character of Jelinek that I mentioned before, and I first started reading him out, and I was like, oh my God, I somehow ended up with some bizarre, like, you know, well, let me tell you. You know, it was the most awful, like, horrifically cliched character I could imagine. I wouldn't have known that had I not been speaking the dialogue out loud and the dialect out loud and being able to hear what the person, that character, was trying to say. So I needed to revise it and go back through it and work with it. And there was some point, you know, around like word 75,000 where I started cursing myself. You couldn't just write a normal modern English, could you, Greg? No, you had to do the stupid fantasy with the dialect. But
leave out all the personal pronouns.
You know, yeah, exactly. Right, I was just thinking, like, well done by us. But that's why you have to go through it, write it, make the mistakes you're going to make, and then go back and fix it. I don't know, is there any way to do it right the first time without making these mistakes?
Yeah, you're going to make mistakes, and that's fine. And the other thing I'd say, well, two things. One, set it aside for a little while. You're too much in the mindset of how you wrote it. If you start looking at it just as soon as you finish it,
right,
you need a little distance, set aside, do something else. If you need to be writing, write something else, and then come back to it. And things that wouldn't have popped in your mind as mistakes going through it right away will now pop in your mind. I think that that's kind of the most helpful thing that you can do. The other part of this is when you do read it aloud, you will find things that your eye would skim over, including, by the way, simple typos. It is remarkable to me how my fingers type on their own, and every time you reread it, your mind, it's like the blind spot that you have.
Yeah.
Your mind fills in what's supposed to be there because it remembers. I actually wanted one time to type the word shoulder. I typed the word soldier. They sound alike. They don't mean anything close to the same thing. I proofed that 5 times. And every time, it didn't bother me at all. I sent it out to my writers group, and they're like, soldier? What? Huh? What is it? I'm supposed to be, it's supposed to be shoulder. Now, if I'd read that aloud, I think I would have stumbled over it. But just reading it on a page, my mind substituted the right word every single time.
Yeah. Others? I think I was moving this way, up in the black and then to the left. The black shirt, please.
Okay. What if you're dealing with not only foreign languages, but foreign languages, you know, as they were in older times? How do you convey the dialect when it's not actually when it's not supposed to actually be English?
Mm-hmm.
And you're trying to sort of historically reconstruct.
Give us, for example, what are you looking at in particular?
Like ancient Roman and Old English, they're talking gay.
You're speaking Italian, but you've got them speaking in English so that the reader can read.
For example, a Celt and a Roman are talking.
There are all sorts of references. And a good place to start is the internet or your librarian. Ancient Roman is really kind of neat when you're talking dialect or dialogue. Romans didn't have a V. They did not pronounce V. And so that's a little shtick that if you don't, if you're unaware of that, people will write that incorrectly. And you can do that with just a couple of searches. I like to go to Barnes & Noble is my friend, and I buy far more many books than I need, but you can find books specifically about that and how it would have been pronounced. We it's spelled V-I-A, but it would have been pronounced Wea. And it means like road or way, V, V-I-A. And I only know this because I studied Latin. Great language to study, by the way, because you can learn all sorts of other languages off of it.
Including more English.
Yes, yes. Sylvan, which we use in our setting now, a Sylvan setting. The Romans would have pronounced it Silwan, because while they had the V, they did not pronounce the V, they pronounced it as a W. You can find all sorts of little interesting things like that just by going to the language section at Barnes & Noble. Another cheap reference books like that. Because I find that I have to have the book just because I want to bend the page down or I want to mark it with a highlighter or something. eBay and Amazon is phenomenal for getting some of these books, old books that might already be marked up just the way that you want them, but you can get it accurate like that. I often have deaf characters in my books, and so I have books on sign language, and I also studied sign language in college. You can convey dialogue. You can convey dialogue with signs, mm-hmm. not verbal, and you can still get language across.
Another resource that I want to suggest, another resource that I want to suggest is to put in a plug for my other profession is colleges, local community colleges or universities have experts in this who spend time, many of them doing nothing but working on replicating it. You know, listen to a medieval scholar read Chaucer and you'll get a different sense of Chaucer than you ever did before. Or listen to someone, for example, read Shakespearean English or Old English, which is very different from Shakespearean English, or Middle English, which is different again. Read, you know, Beowulf in its original form, and it'll be a very different thing than what you would have imagined otherwise. And so those people and those institutions, and I know this because I know these people, are always very, very excited and grateful to have the chance to speak to people about the way in which this stuff actually would have been used at the time. And they are significant resources as well.
Are you on Facebook? You can type in a question on Facebook asking for people to help you out with a particular dialogue or for a particular country.
So long as you check their credentials.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I know something about Shakespeare. I lived in England once and I...
For example, Ramsey speaks fluent Japanese and has lived in Japan. And if I had a question on Japanese customs or dialogue or something, I would drop them an email. So there are people that you can...
And since I seem to be the expert on the panel on shooting, you know, you can do the Sean Connery Hunt for Red October. I cannot be bothered to do a Russian accent, but, you know, I'm at least going to do an English accent for the entire
thing. You know, throw in yes.
And it's not what I recommend, but in a pinch, or if it's not central to your story, doing something, you know, doing one thing that you found and doing it consistently to convey that this is old Italian, although in English, is enough probably to get you through with a significant portion. I'm not suggesting that you write poorly.
Don is asking you to cheat. Please cheat.
You know, pocketbooks. Pocketbooks. If you poke around on their website, you can email some of their editors and stuff. They have people over in England who translate the pocket Star Trek books into 5, 6, 7 different languages.
Yeah.
And they're real friendly on hooking you up with somebody. You can say, here's my sentences. Can you translate into the French for me? And not only will these wonderful people translate for you, but they will explain to you why certain words are certain ways. Male words, female words. It's just cool.
Yeah.
I found that by accident.
Or you put a little segment actually in it. I mean, because she's trying to convey ancient Italian in English, which is different than having it translated
right.
into ancient Italian. But if you take a little phrase and actually present that in Italian or ancient Italian, to give a feel for it and then give the translation.
Oh, that's really good.
You know, and maybe make that translation a little stylistically distinct, then using that distinctive translation later on conveys the ancient Italian, which nobody's going to be able to read anyhow.
Yeah. We are past time. Sorry. We are past time. Thank you, everybody. If you haven't already, please bring tickets up, and thanks so much.